Bonjour à toutes et à tous. Bienvenue à ce nouvel épisode des balados de l'Institut d'études anciennes et médiévales de l'Université Laval. Aujourd'hui, nous recevons Mme Orit Pelleg-Baquette, accompagnée de M. Jonathan Bourgel. Bonjour à toutes et à tous. Je prends un moment afin de vous aviser que cet épisode fut le premier enregistré il y a de cela plusieurs semaines. Veuillez nous excuser les quelques erreurs techniques, notamment au niveau du son des invités. Bonne écoute et bon visionnage.
Let's start it now. So, Mrs. Pelleg-Baquette, who are you and what's your area of expertise?
First of all, thank you for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here. I'm currently the head of the Classical Archaeology Sub-Department at the Institute of Archaeology at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. I specialize in art and architecture of the Hellenistic and Roman Southern Levant, mainly modern-day Israel, Palestine, Transjordan, Libya, Syria, Lebanon, and Egypt. But the main focus of my work has been in recent years the architecture and art of King Herod and the Hasmoneans that were rulers of Judea before him. And we're here today to speak about Herod.
That's great. I'm going to ask you the same question, Mr. Bourguet. Basically, who are you and what's your area of expertise?
I'm the historian of the Second Temple period, means about the time of Jesus, the history of the Jews at the time of Jesus, and I've dealt as well with Herod, so I'm very happy to have the opportunity to discuss here with Orit, who's a well-known scholar, about this subject.
That's great. So let's jump in. Basically, who is King Herod?
King Herod is a clan king of a not very big kingdom in the Eastern Mediterranean, namely modern-day Israel, more or less. This region was situated in the periphery of the Roman Empire, the border with the Parthians, later on the border with Arabia. But it is well situated in a very strategic point connecting Asia, Africa, and Europe. So it's an important junction for every empire in the region and for the Roman Empire as well. So King Herod was, as I said, he wasn't an independent king. He was a king under the patronage of the first emperor, Octavian, later on Augustus. He was born around 73 BCE. We don't know exactly where he was born, but we know that he has, despite the fact that he is ruling over a Jewish it's a multi-ethnic community, but mostly the big majority is of Jewish people. His background is a bit different. His father comes from a family of Idumean converts. Idumea was a region south of Judea in the Persian and Hellenistic period. And his mother is actually a Nabataean princess coming from southeastern Jordan. His family, despite the fact that he was not part of the Jewish elite, his family was well connected with the ruling family, the Hasmoneans. His grandfather Antipas was the ruler, or he was appointed to be in charge of the region of Idumea already under Alexandria Nels, the Hasmonean king, in the beginning of the first century BCE. His father, Antipater, was later on closely connected with Hyrcanus II, again, the Hasmonean king. And later on, through a very tumultuous period of the Roman conquest of Judea in 63 BCE by Pompey the Great, and later on during the civil war within the late Roman Republic, when power shifted from Pompey to Caesar and then to the to Cassius and Brutus and then to Mark Antony and later on to Augustus, Herod managed to maneuver and with his shrewd political senses eventually to keep his close connections with the Romans, and that was the reason why he eventually was appointed king over Judea by the Roman Senate, by Mark Antony and Augustus.
All right. Do you have something to say about this?
Actually, Herod is a well-known figure, probably thanks to Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, who describes Herod as a cruel ruler.
According to Matthew, Herod planned to kill Jesus, the infant, by killing all the young children in the area of Bethlehem. But the fact is that when you read our main source on Herod, that is Josephus, you realize that Herod was a puzzling figure, a very shrewd leader who managed to navigate through a troubled period of civil wars in the Roman world, and who managed to consolidate his power and to promote his political interests, in particular through his construction program.
I think therefore you're here to discuss about the reflection of the reign of Herod in his constructions. So I think that's a very important side of the talk we should have today.
Yes, so indeed Herod is a well-studied historical figure. And the reason for that is that we have a very detailed description of Herod in Josephus, both in Antiquities and the Jewish War. But luckily, we have not just the detailed description of his deed, but also of the buildings that he had left, because Herod was one of the greatest builders in the Eastern Mediterranean ever. And you cannot come to Israel without seeing some of the remains. If you go to the coastline, you would see his city, the new harbor, the city that he built at Caesarea Maritima. If you would go to the Judean desert, you will see his magnificent palace at Masada in Jerusalem. He rebuilt the temple and expanded the temple platform. So if you go today to the old city, you see the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount. This was initiated at least by King Herod. So his buildings are all over throughout the region, and we know from Josephus that he also built and donated funding and initiated constructions outside of his realm, in Syria, in the Aegean islands, and so forth. And it is interesting to try and understand why does he need, like, he has two palaces at least on Masada, three in Jericho, one in Samaria, one in Caesarea, two in Jerusalem. Why did he have to build so many palaces? Why did he have to build so much? And probably part of it is his personality, but also he used the constructions in order to legitimize his rule. So as I said before, he was not part of the former dynasty that was, the Hasmoneans were high priests, and they were eventually became also kings of the Jewish nation, of the Hasmonean state. Herod was very far from that line, and he had to, he used his building program, first of all, to base his rule and make sure that the Roman patronage still thinks of him as a legitimate ruler of Judea. So to keep his good connections with Augustus and the Roman Empire, but then also to ease the Jewish people in Judea so they would not revolt against him. So they know that he would not change their traditions and contribute, actually eventually contribute to the temple itself. So in his palace, as we can see, he works within many limitations of the Jewish tradition. Mm-hmm. For example, in that period, from the Asmoneans onward, it is not a custom to portray human figures and animals. So he cannot present statues of him all over the country. Of course, the Jews also would protest if he would build temples to Apollo or to Jupiter. So he does not build temples to foreign gods out inside Judea, only outside. But he does erect three temples in honor of Augustus in Rome, in Caesarea Samaria, and Paneon up in the north. So he needs to keep a very steady line in order to maintain both his loyalty to his patrons and but not to upset too much the Jewish population.
Yeah, I think it's a very important point. It's to understand that first, as you said, he has to please his patrons, the Romans, and to show them that Judea is part of the Roman Empire. And it has to be stressed as well that within the boundaries of his kingdom live different populations. The Jews on one side, who have specific needs, religious, cultural needs, and Gentiles. And Herod had to find a way to please everyone. And by using his constructions, actually finds a very clever way to answer the needs of each population. That's what he does. But actually, a question that, do you think that the Jews accept this kind of agreement? Do Jews in Herod's time accept the fact that in the pagan parts of his kingdom, he builds pagan temples and Roman cities? Or?
So the only thing we have is to answer this kind of question is the historical testimony of Flavius Josephus. And of course, Josephus was born after Herod's death. He lived in the first century, in the later first century CE. But he gives us in his testimony the speech that Herod gave to the people before he started to renovate the temple around 20 BCE. And he explains there, and I guess this is a sort of an apologetic, that even if this is not exactly the speech that Herod gave, then it would be a similar one. He explained to the Jewish people of Jerusalem that all the things he had done before, that is building the temples for Augustus and Rome in all those Gentile cities, and even in Jerusalem, although there was no temple for Augustus, there were games in the Hippodrome and the amphitheater in honor of Augustus. So he explains that he had done all of that, so now he can finally, so to ease and please the Romans, and now he can turn to the really important thing, and that is to rebuild the temple. Because when the newcomers from Babylon rebuilt Solomon's temple, they had very modest means to do that. And the new temple was not as magnificent as Solomon's temple. And the Bible recounts how the elders who still remembered Solomon's temple cried when they saw the new temple. So he wants to fix that. But Jews might be still suspicious. So he says that he already prepared everything. So before even, one stone is touched, we have all the new stones cut, all the...
So they have the material.
All the raw materials, all the, inside the temple, only priests can go. So you had to you know, to prepare the priest to be able to work inside the temple and build and rebuild it. So he gives all that in his speech. So you can understand from that probably there was a sort of protest or rejection to what he was doing, but he's with his grand project of the expansion of the Temple Mount and rebuilding the temple, he tried to compensate them.
So we saw that Herod loved to promote his political interests, but do you think that he had a personal vision?
So I think he did, because to ease his Roman patrons, it was enough that he would build those temples and make those celebrations and games in honor of Augustus and his Actium battle. But Herod goes a step further. He also introduces into Judea many new forms of architecture, of buildings, of art, of decoration, mosaic floors, wall paintings, raw materials, building techniques that are all Roman. So it seems that he is trying, maybe it's either to show that this is another way of projecting his close connections with Rome, so he is being able to bring all these new things to Judea. Maybe it's because he wants to be fashionable, but maybe he sincerely believes in the superiority of the Roman culture. So we can see it in the harbor of Caesarea. He brings pozzolana, the volcanic ash, to be used in the breakwater. He brings pigments from the Roman mercury mines in Spain to use for his red, bright colors in the frescoes in the palace in Jericho. So this is in terms of raw materials. We have new building techniques that were never in use in Judea before, the opus reticulatum, the opus tactile, I don't know, you know, but architectural designs. So if you would go to Judea, you'd see a very accelerated process of acculturation into the Roman Empire.
And do you think that it was personally involved in the building?
So it's very hard to say. So there has been a debate going on among scholars how much Herod was involved in the planning, not just the initiation, but also the planning of his architectural projects. The late Professor Ehud Netzer, who excavated in few of Herod's construction projects in Jericho, Herodium, Masada, and Caesarea, he believed that Herod, there is too much of common characteristics, mm-hmm. of these and special and unique characteristics in these buildings that it's hard to believe that you would have just, you know, several architects working for the king. For example, he would use very typical of him to choose dramatic locations for his palaces. For example, the northern palace in Masada is built up on a cliff, just hang there in the like hanging up in the sky. His palace in Caesarea is on a promontory, projecting into the sea. He also fights against the natural topography in some ways. Is playing God. In Jerusalem, the new expanded mountain projects outside of the original boundary, topographic boundaries of Mount Moriah. It expands much further into the ravines on both sides of this mountain. In Herodium, he creates a volcano-shaped, perfect mountain that can be seen from afar. to serve as his memorial eventually. Also in Jericho, he built a small tell, a small mound to build his one of the triclinia of his palace up there. Even though he built a lot, some would say too much, and everything is grand, there's also some economic, functional appeal behind this. Like, he would not use just ashlars everywhere. He would use just field stones, but cover it with nice plaster. He would, like, rarely do we have stones that are brought from far away, so normally we'd use the local stones. And also many times we can see very nicely at Herodium and other sites, his artisans, the people who worked for Herod's construction project, they had to carve like dozens of Corinthian capitals and Ionic capitals. And this was time consuming. So you can see that they would carve just half a capital. The uncarved part would be in the shade. So only if you really looked, you would see that it's not finished. And only the half that is facing the garden, or you could see it easily, that would be fully carved. These two sides are very interesting in that respect.
But I think that when it comes to the question of his personal involvement, maybe we should mention two sites. Actually, I have slightly mentioned. First, Herodium, which is the site of his burial. And it's quite clear that he was involved in the building and the reshaping of the site all along his reign. And his buildings in Idumea. Because we have to say that, to remind us, that's something that you said before Herod, his family, on his father's side, comes from Idumea. So it's very interesting to see what Herod built in Idumea. So could you say some few words?
First of all, about Herodium, we know that unlike the other desert fortress palaces that Herod's built in Hyrcania and Alexandrion, Kypros, etc., there were all. In all of these places, there were Hasmonean antecedents. So Herod rebuilt and enlarges former palaces. Herodium is built anew by Herod. And this, the reason for that is because he has a special connection with the site. In 40 BCE, when a scion of the Hasmonean family, Matitias Antigonos, combined with the Parthians, they revolt against Rome, against Herod, and Herod has to, they manage to take Jerusalem, and Herod has to flee. And he, on his way to Masada and then Petra, he passes by the site later to be known as Herodium, and on that place, his mother's carriage is turned over. And for a minute, he thinks that his mother has died in that accident, and Josephus recounts how he took his sword out and was about to commit suicide, and his friend stopped him. Eventually, they managed to fight the Parthians and Asmoneans that pursue them and continue their journey, and his mother is fine. But that was a very traumatic event. And eventually in that place, he builds his one of his grand palaces, which eventually became also his last burial place, resting place. And also this is the only place that is, so he built Caesarea, named after Augustus, Sebaste, Samaria after Augustus. But this is the site that he named after his own name. Mm-hmm. And indeed, one of the so why does he flee through Herodium? Because Herodium is on the borderline between Idumea to the south and Judea to the north. So he seeks, and Masada is also part of Idumea. So he seeks help within the territory of his forefathers, where he thinks he might have more sympathy to his cause and he can get some assistance. Herodium is an important site in Idumea. Further to the south, we have two other sites in Idumea, which are more hard to connect to Herod, but were still connected by most scholars with the construction project of Herod, and that is the Cave of the Patriarchs in Hebron. And not far from there, we have another cultic site called Elone Mamre. Both these sites are very, in their shape, they are very reminiscent of the Herodian Temple Mount. They are big enclosures with large retaining walls decorated with pilasters. The Cave of the Patriarchs in Hebron still stands almost complete until today. Most of the outer walls are from the days of Herod. And the problem is that Josephus doesn't mention that these two places were built by Herod. And the strange thing is also that he doesn't speak about the Cave of the Patriarch in Hebron, which is a very important Jewish site, as if he knows it. As he even doesn't seem to have visited Hebron, because he says that the people of the place, they tell him. So he describes it shortly, but he does not connect it with Herod. But due to the similarities between this monument and the Herodian Temple Mount, and also due to the fact that it is situated in Idumea, and due to the fact that the place commemorates the forefathers of the Jewish nation, which are also the forefathers of the Idumeans, and that is, it turns this monument to be a monument for both nations, a monument that can combine them and unite them. So scholars have suggested that it was also built by the king.
So after that, what does the king's mausoleum teach us about basically his life, his culture, and his greatness?
Actually, the mausoleum teaches us about his, it also teaches us about all these things, but it also teaches us about his last years. So if we speak about Herod's reign, we have the between 37 when he actually becomes, I mean, he was appointed in 40, but he manages to take over the country from the Parthians only in 37 BCE. And between then and 31 BCE, still he is in his first years in the reign, and his apex is in the between, let's say, 30 and 10 BCE. But his later years, at least according to the description that we have in Josephus, are marked by a very unhealthy relationship within the family. His wife, Mariamne, is being executed, and then her two sons, Alexander and Aristobulus, are being executed. And the fact that he was becoming older, and his sons became more intolerant and were pushing him to choose among them. He had 10 wives and dozens of children, so he had to make his decision on his inheritance. And Josephus describes 7 different wills that he passed or made every time he changed his mind. So at Herodium, we can see that, his shifts of changes of minds, because according to Ehud Netzer, the excavator, the original plan was to build a monumental tomb at Lower Herodium, below the palace, the fortress palace mountain. But then he changed his mind and built his nice mausoleum on the slope. But then again, he felt that this was not enough. So he turned the entire mountain into a memorial, shaping it like a big volcano, like a big tumulus. So all these changes they nicely go hand in hand with what we know from the testimony of Josephus about his later years, and going back to the question of his, you know, his footprints on his architectural construction, this is can clearly be seen in Herodium, especially in concerning the burial.
Okay, that's great. Do you have something, Seb?
I think that Herodium is maybe the best example. It's a reflection of his life, of his reign, from the very building of the site, which is a fortress, in order to protect himself because of the traumatic events of 40 BCE when he has to fly from Jerusalem and he's looking for a fortress to get some protection. And then it's very interesting to see how the site evolves, how it reshapes the site all around his reign till the very end. And then it covers part of the construction that had to be down in order to erect the mausoleum. So it's very, and it's his legacy. So it's very, I love the site.
That's great.
Beautiful site.
That's great. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lid. It was a pleasure to have you here.
It was my pleasure to be here.